Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on April 16th, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Please welcome co-director Tom Johnson. This is such a beautiful movie. I saw it when it first came out, and it's really astonishing to see. It's a different movie today, 34 years later. To you, is that true?
It is. I haven't seen it.
Hold it up a little.
I haven't seen it recently either, since we had it remastered and digital.
8 years ago.
Yeah, and it is a different movie.
There are ironies.
You could make the same ironies.
Well, there are new ironies. For example, the smokescreen in Lower Manhattan to protect it from attack. You wouldn't have known that in 1984 and other things. But a lot of the things that they were projecting of the future came true within 20 years, and a lot of them are the roots of our problems today, do you think?
Exactly.
Like the highways through cities that we're trying to undo now, and all the and our dependence on oil, everything. Today, archival films like this are rather common. They're all over Netflix and streaming services. But it was very difficult to do a film like this 34 years ago. Actually, we say 34, but it took you, you and Lance Bird, 10 years to make this?
Well, we were working on a series of films about the 1930s, and the film we made called America Lost and Found, which was kind of the middle class experience of the 30s, ended with the World's Fair, and we just realized there was such a rich resonance with everyone we talked to. The fair was a lot closer to that time.
It was exactly the time from the documentary today, about 34
right.
years.
So we realized there was that it was a wonderful metaphor for the change in our national psyche and for many, many things as we were able to do in the longer film. It served as the ending for America Lost and Found, but that was 5 minutes, and this is
84 minutes,
right?
Yeah.
You were saying that it is, it was a very different experience to make this film. At that time, there were many archives of newsreel film and
found footage
found
like the
footage.
Prelinger archive.
Well, Prelinger,
he was just starting
was
then,
just
I think.
Starting,
yeah,
right. And we were all looking in these same places for the footage. And now there are a few places that you look, primarily Getty, and they've acquired all of the archives that were out there at UCLA or Sherman Gutenberg.
By the way, I'm in the credits. I'm Manhattan Movie Time. I must have sold you stock footage, Manhattan Movie Time.
Okay.
So I sold you stock footage, what that's worth. And Karen Cooper, the director of Film Forum, because we opened it here. And
yes.
Greg Ford, who I still see, sold you the Fleischer cartoon, I guess. But what really stands out in the film is not the newsreels, are the home movies. And the Kodachrome, which is astonishing to see today. Can you tell us what Kodachrome was?
Just one more thought about
sure.
the newsreels, because when the Universal Collection was at the National Archives, and there were the Paramount, I was at Sherman Greenberg, I
right.
think, but there were just tons of outtakes and a lot of the best of the black and white footage came from outtakes from newsreels, and over the years these have been deacquisitioned for storage, for want of storage space, and
Where were they deacquisitioned from?
The National Archives.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They closed their Anacostia. I'm not sure of the details, but it was happening. Some of the people who did research for the film were here. Could probably be more specific, but I think a lot of the best stuff that we were able to go through when we were looking is no longer
actually around. A lot of newsreels are being put online, and the Packard Humanities Foundation is making all of the Hearst Metrotone newsreels available online. It's a years-long project. Well, so a lot of the things are going to be available to researchers.
My point is that the newsreels will be, but it's those hundreds of feet of outtakes and alternative takes that they did that may not be around.
How much now, footage did you amass for this?
Oh,
must be 10 times what we see or more.
Probably, yeah. I don't really remember that. We tried, because we were operating on a budget, we looked at a lot more than we printed.
Of course.
In order to get the Kodachrome and the home movies, we had several weekends at the Queen's Museum, which was one of the buildings at the fair, the New York Pavilion, where we invited local people to bring their movies and show them for each other. And we, the ones we were interested in, we made an agreement with the people that we would restore them and get them into good shape. And we came across the Matuzas footage.
The two Lithuanian brothers seen in the film.
All of the really gorgeous close-ups of fairgoers, most of the pavilions were from a collection of a guy whose uncle, great-uncle, was told to retire. He was a compulsive workaholic in the garment trades, and he was told to retire, or he was going to expire and take up a hobby. And so he took up amateur movie making as a hobby, and he worked just as hard at that. He was at the fair almost every day, according to his nephew, and all of that. It was like his collection, I've forgotten exactly how much footage was there, but it was almost like we could send a cameraman back in time and say, is there anything from the transportation pavilion if we needed it, or Dolly?
I mean, everything looks like they were shot by a professional cinematographer.
Right.
Pretty much everything.
The guy was amazing.
And luckily, Kodachrome had just been introduced about 4 years earlier, so this was a color World's Fair.
Yes,
33,
was.
Chicago was not, and this in 39 no. was.
Well, it also, I guess one of the reasons it's kind of central to memory, more so than Chicago, even in the general American consciousness rather than just the New York consciousness, which is clearly true, is that it was the last great World's Fair. They have tried to do other ones since, but in those days the World's Fair meant that people from all over the world would come, different groups of scientists would come and have seminars and meetings planned around the fair, and they'd come by ocean liner. Now there, it's quite possible to travel to Europe and back and forth a couple times a year.
True, yeah.
By airplane, and go to conferences. And the World's Fair was really the gathering point for future-minded folks. And after World War II, when transportation became much easier, it wasn't such a big deal, even though we had the New York Fair and the Seattle Fair and Montreal Expo. They just never measured up in importance to the last great one in 39.
Yeah. I loved the 64 World's Fair. My mother kept saying it was nothing compared to 39. Any questions in the audience? Raise your hand and Nico will bring you a microphone. Oh, there's one up front here.
I was wondering, do you know if the model that they built when they were envisioning the fair, if the model that was at the offices in the Empire State Building, if that model still exists?
No, I don't think the model. I haven't seen the model. We weren't able to track it down. In the Queens Museum, there's a model of New York City.
Which was introduced at the 64 World's Fair.
Right, and that plays a prominent part in Todd Haynes' new film. I think it's called Wonderstruck.
Wonderstruck, right. By the way, there's a new Netflix movie called Kodachrome.
Okay.
Yes, coming out later this month. Not that I want to plug Netflix here. Another question up front?
Did the Trilon in the Perisphere have any function other than just being symbols? I mean, did people go inside it? Was there an elevator?
Well, yes, the Democracy City was inside the Perisphere, which was another. It wasn't nearly as spectacular or expansive as the General Motors Pavilion, but it was a model of the future, and folks did go in the Trilon. I don't think. I mean, it wasn't part of the. You couldn't go up and see from there. It was more a symbol. But inside the Perisphere was the future.
This is addressed to all the World's Fair buffs in the audience. Were the Trilon and Perisphere in the same location where the Unisphere is now?
You know, I
anybody?
I imagine that was so. Yeah. I haven't really.
They were. Okay, good. I've been bugging me for 50 years.
Well, over I know here? That the time capsule has been, they've had to really kind of protect it and put up notices as to where it is. It kind of dropped completely out of
there's
sight.
There's no marker. They also dropped one for 64 Westinghouse.
Yeah.
Now there's no Westinghouse. So
right.
I mean, do we really have to leave it there for 5,000 years? Can we just dig it up now?
I would think 1,000 would do
the five, it. It was so America-centric, that time capsule, wasn't it? Nothing from the rest of the world. But in 5,000 years, they'll be listening to Amos and Andy, I guess.
Well, it's
interesting.
It's interesting. A lot of the industrial pavilions made films like the Westinghouse, and we had references to them, but they were corporate historians don't exist, and we went to General Motors and
some
Johns
of the companies
Manville.
Too. Actually, no.
Well.
I think it's an afterthought for a lot of companies, yeah.
I mean, there was a film that we hunted and hunted for called Pete Trolium and His
Cousins. I had a copy.
You did?
We had a copy, and in fact, it was directed, the puppets were by a friend of mine named Lou Bunnan.
Okay.
And it was a combination puppet film and a live actor talking to the puppet film. And I had a print that Lou Bunnan gave me. And I think Greg Ford has it, but it was a live end film thing, and the stage part was directed by Joseph Losey.
Okay.
And it was the Standard Oil Pavilion, I believe. Yeah,
right.
I wasn't there at the 39th Fair. I just knew that. Okay.
Well, we searched for it and couldn't find it.
Well, I will.
Wish we'd
next time we do this, we'll show it,
right.
And I'll be the live guy.
Okay.
Over here, third row.
Hello. I enjoyed the film very much. I'm really glad to have had a chance to see it. And it was very honest on some one point that I found quite shocking was the way that these young girls in almost non-existent bathing suits were being paraded around and displayed at this family values.
Not that section.
I beg your pardon?
Not that section of the fair. Every did not have.
Well,
the, yeah.
I don't know, but I know that they found it funny that the girls were wearing this split underwear under these big ball gowns. And anyway, I'm just saying that the Hays office was already censoring Hollywood films very strictly, any sensuality and all that. And this was, what, 3 or 4 years after the creation of the Hays office. So I've just found it curious and that this type of ribaldry about women's bodies was being displayed. Thank you.
Well, I think that's fair. And I'm not sure why or how much it was sanctioned by the World's Fair Committee. But at any state fair or county fair, there was a tent sort of toward the outside full of, you couldn't get in unless you were 16, and there was a barker outside drawing you in.
It was pretty much a fairground kind of,
fairgrounds
or carnival
thing,
kind of atmosphere. Yeah. Well, the Hays office only monitored movies, not live shows like this. But I think a lot of this was caught by lascivious filmmakers, you know.
Yeah. Off. Well, this guy that he filmed everything.
It's like the real in Cinema Paradiso with all the nudity. There's one over here. Can we get the house lights up a little higher? Is that it? Cause we can't.
There we go. The 1876 and late 1800s and early 1900s saw World's Fairs in Philadelphia and St. Louis and Chicago, and they drew enormous crowds. I mean, there was an estimate I saw once that the 1876 fair attracted 25% of the people in the United States. Why do you think it was that the 39 fair didn't draw the same sort of crowds as the World's Fairs that had come before it in America?
Well, it's my understanding that they did very well with their draw, and but they had over-predicted the attractiveness. Now, the Chicago Fair and St. Louis and the expositions that you're referring to were more in the center of the country too, and I think they drew. I really don't know. We didn't go into that. We just were aware that the fair was constantly behind its projections of popularity, no matter how popular it seemed.
And there were movies in 1939 and radio and vaudeville and all these things that weren't around in the 19th century. Well, vaudeville a little bit. And also 39 was a pretty good year for movies, don't forget. So that was big competition. Swing bands. Swing was huge in popularity, which is why they brought all those swing bands to the fair in 1940. You know, there's some vestiges left of the 39 World's Fair. And we have some pictures of them, what you could still see from the fair. Let's take a look.
Yeah.
This is the New York City building under construction. You could see the Trilon and Perisphere are also under construction. The New York City building is the only pavilion that still stands from the 39 World's Fair. Next. Here's an aerial shot of it. Next. And between 1946 and 1950, after the fair, it was the headquarters of the UN General Assembly. And in 1964, it became the only building that was in the New York World's Fair, the only building from 39 that served the same purpose in the New York World's Fair. And next, that's when they introduced the Panorama of New York, which is still there today. And it's constantly changing, obviously. They have the FU building in the middle now, if you know what I mean. Next. And in the early 70s, it became the Queens Museum. I think, has anyone been there recently? I think they changed the facade. Okay, next. And you can see on exhibit an original tour guide uniform. Here's a cover of Life magazine with a model wearing it. Next. It says, Girl Guide, World's Fair. Inside the story was Pretty Girls, a Hit at the Fair. That was the name of the article. And but guess what? We have someone in the audience wearing that very uniform. Heidi, come on up here. Can we get the lights? This is unbelievable.
All right.
Now in the center, Heidi, center. In mint condition. Wait a minute. She has two of them. I can just imagine your apartment.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Where do you give tours? Look at this hat. Unbelievable. It's the exact same thing she's wearing. You could have been a Powers model. Okay, thank you, Heidi. Okay. And next, what do we have? Oh, the parachute jump, one of the most popular attractions at the fair. And in 1941, it moved to Steeplechase Park. And it remained next. That's kind of what it's now known as the Eiffel Tower of Brooklyn. It remained a parachute jump until 1964 when Steeplechase closed. Some people think it might have lasted a few more years. But Steeplechase was torn down in 64 by who? Does anybody know? Trump's father, Fred C. Trump, a name that will live in infamy, along with his sons. Okay. Okay, next. And this is my favorite, the Trilon Theater on Queens Boulevard in Rego Park, built in 39, the year of the fair. Next. This, it closed as a theater. I remember driving down Queens Boulevard in December 1999, so it was a theater for 60 years. Next. Now on top, you could see the interior. I hope it's still there. The Trilon is built into the terrazzo floor, and the Perisphere is in the mosaic ticket counter. We hope the Jewish Orthodox Jewish Center did not destroy that. But you'll notice that next door, there's still the Trilon liquors. And next, I wanted to include this because the most beloved mayor in the history of New York grew up right in this neighborhood. And that statue is only about a 5 to 10 minute walk from here on LaGuardia Place. And next, I wanted to show you my little bit of World's Fair memorabilia, a little pathetic next to Heidi's uniform. But this is a mint book of tickets owned by this guy, Leroy Flegel, likely named Roger. He never used it because, you know, he looks like a gigolo, doesn't he? So he never went to anything. So I have it here. I might sell it to Heidi. I don't know. Okay, that's the World's Fair in New York today. Does anybody know of any other vestiges? You know, I was at Penn Station once when they were doing some construction and they dismantled a column and they uncovered a sign that said World's Fair Trains. And it was obviously from 39, not 64, and then they covered it. So that exists, but it's under a column. Oh, but yeah, the Aquacade was the other thing from 39 that survived into 64. Is that still there? No, but okay. Back there? Oh,
yeah. I have a quick question.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the film very much, but I was expecting to see a celebration of the World's Fair, but it kind of morphed into more juxtaposing all those war themes. And I was just interested in when you decided to make that film, was that more of a political angle you decided to do as opposed to just presenting the fair as a celebration of life?
Well, I think the first part of the film is a celebration, and the second part kind of brings it into reality, into the reality of the future in a more serious way. I think there's both the celebration and the foreshadowings are part of the story of the fair, and that was what we set out to tell, that story, not just the entertainment value or the celebratory value of the exposition.
At the time this came out, there were a lot of people who remembered the fair, lots of people.
Right.
Now there's almost, you do have to be 90 or over to remember it. So it's no longer a nostalgia piece, really.
No.
Never really intended it to be.
No, not really, but I think that there's a healthy dollop of nostalgia in it. I hope we were able to convey both of those threads and some others as well.
I wanted to also talk about the challenges of doing an archival film in 35 years ago. Nowadays, we have lots of them. As I said, we're showing one at Film Forum, Hitler's Hollywood. But today, it's relatively easy to take old footage and digitize it and edit it. But in those days, you had to take the film and make a dupe negative and a work print. It was, can you explain the process a bit?
Well,
maybe it's too much.
It was a lot more complicated than it is today. I kind of enjoyed that process of actually
handling
the film and opening the 35 millimeter cans, not knowing quite whether you were going to find just nitrate dust or some wonderful treasure that you didn't expect would be there. Now, I think research is not that much fun.
Closer.
Not that much fun.
Yeah.
And
also, you weren't using negatives. You were using prints, so you had to copy a print to make a dupe negative. And sometimes the results, if the lab work wasn't good, the results could be not so great. And this all looks wonderful. You had a great lab, John Allen.
John Allen,
yeah,
was as much a creative part of the film as Lance and John Crowley and myself.
John Crowley, who wrote the wonderful narration. Over here?
Yes.
Well, I'll wait for the mic.
I loved it and learned so much. The one thing that I had hoped to see and that was left out was that the fair featured essentially the world's first modern 3D film, the Chrysler Pavilion, and they made it in 1939 in black and white in 3D, and then they redid it in full color 3D for the 1940 World's Fair, and newlyweds Grace and Morris Marks attended that film in color and came home and did what newlyweds are supposed to do, and I popped out 9 months later.
And are you the one who was conceived at 39?
I'm the career. I've had a career in 3D.
I know you.
Of course you know
me. Oh, my God.
And
he made us a 3D t-shirt in 1988. He also made a Rolling Stones video in 3D. You directed it, right?
I directed the Rolling Stones.
All right, sit down.
3D.
Yeah. But Gerald Martin, no, I know.
Hired me.
But Gerald, come on, this was not. This was not. Yes, we did. I don't even know if I have one. But the problem with the 3D T-shirt, you have to give someone the glasses to see the front. Okay,
yeah.
But there were 3D movies. You know that you're a historian. There were 3D movies.
There were short 3D movies, not really highly produced, and they were not projected using polarizing filters. So the World's Fair, Chrysler Pavilion, had essentially the world's first major 3D
okay.
film.
Okay, all right. We'll show it here. Okay. Does it exist?
Maybe.
Okay, that sounds like a no to me.
I really don't know whether we looked for it. It's been so long that I don't recall. But
and showing it in the film would have been challenging also.
Yes,
you'd have to hand out glasses for a minute.
Well, you noticed they were watching television. the monitor was off screen. I don't know whether they had not solved the
you're talking
scan
in the Middletons?
Problem. Yeah, the Middletons.
By the way, that was documentary gold, finding that short. The Middletons at the Westinghouse Pavilion.
Yeah.
With Electro. Electro, the most amazing thing I've ever seen. Electro. Yeah. I wonder what he'd think of Siri, this guy.
Television is on a mirror.
Oh, I'm back.
It's one of the old, the very first sets had it, that the set right. was down like this, and you looked one. Down one. On it.
Okay.
Well, no, the mirror reflected the tube.
Right.
That and there were sets in New York in 1939. Right. Yes. This audience is pretty smart. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
Oh, are you ready?
Yeah, you have the mic? Then we're ready.
Yes, I do. I wanted to ask, who is the family that was featured in the movie? I'm just assuming that's not Jason Robards as the 10-year-old.
Oh, that's a good question. That's
is
a great question.
Is that Jason Robards' family?
No, it isn't, but you're not the first person to ask that question. He does such a convincing job of putting himself in the driver's seat. I really admire his narration. There were 10 to 12-year-olds who keep popping up in front of the cameras, and they all look enough alike. One was this, I think, the son of the guy I was talking about who did all of the photography. There was another person who came out of the woodwork at our Queens Museum screenings for the public, and another guy who was in film who, his name I think was Ken Resnick, and he heard we were doing it and came up with footage of himself. So there were actually three young men with curly dark hair that keep popping up, and they look enough alike that they get morphed into Jason Robards.
There's an old man in the beginning who looks like Jason.
Oh yeah.
But Jason was about 17 and 30,
yeah.
not 10.
Yeah.
So. Any other questions? Oh, wait a minute. We have someone who actually worked on the film here. Yeah. Linda.
It's such a pleasure to be in this theater to see this film. And to that's perfect
that's,
music.
That's the 3D that's, guy's that's phone. Someone. Wouldn't you know it?
It's the guy's phone. But yeah, I was curious how you felt being able to see it on a large screen and with such a wonderful audience, the combination of this moment. How do you feel seeing it after all the work you put into it and the 10 years of working with John? And
well, that's a very good question. And I'm quite moved seeing it on a screen like this and with an audience like this. We have shown it occasionally over the years since it was made, but mainly to schools and not since it was remastered. So this is quite a moving experience for me. And thank you all for coming. And
thank you.
Making the experience.
Tom Johnson. Thank you, Tom. We don't normally give flowers to men, but we're not.
I would appreciate
we're an equal
it,
opportunity
you.
Flower person. By the way, Linda was a research. What?
Somebody
asked me
it was on DVD.
Well, that's an interesting question. We are trying to the rights for this were purchased the rights were purchased for limited showings back when it was first made, and we're trying to clear that so we can put it in distribution, because we do now have a print or a distributable copy.
And I'd like to show it here for at least a week. Someone asked me why we're only showing it one night. There's a reason, but we'd love to show it for a longer run.
Well,
when we reopen.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thank you so much for coming, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.